You are listening to The Mombcast, the best weekly comic book podcast recorded in Southampton, England on Thursday nights. In our 170th episode, we talk about this week's comics, cover a little bit of comic news, and in his spotlight, James talks about Asterix at the Olympic Games by R. Goscinny and A. Adazo. Around the mic tonight are...
Hello, I'm James.
Hello, I'm Nick. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Oh, that went fucking brilliantly.
I think it did.
Yeah.
Jane isn't here this week because she's very busy.
Yeah, she's otherwise engaged.
Shit,
I wasn't meant to say, was I? And Steve will be furious when he finds out. Oh, God, she hasn't told him yet.
Yeah.
It'd be embarrassing.
How are you, James?
I'm fine. I'm a bit... First proper week back from Christmas. I'm still convinced Christmas has made me dreadfully ill. I don't feel myself at all.
I think I know what you mean. I feel like I've got a cold, but there's more aching with it this time than I'm used to. Do your glands
always
ache?
Always.
Mine don't normally, but after I'm really Christmas. Feeling them at the moment.
And my bones ache. I can't work out, is it Christmas, am I ill, or am I just old? And I can't work out which of those it is.
It's a worry. I think I need to get just generally checked out, because, my glands really hurt. And every now and then, not very often, but sometimes my balls...
Can you? It's the glands around your neck that hurt as well.
No, yeah. my neck glands.
Yeah.
My neck glands specifically
as
hurt.
As we've gone south, we should specify which of your glands it is.
But every now and then, it's not actually my balls, it's just underneath ache a little bit. I feel that because it's just us men here.
Mm. Are we getting close to the... You've got
Kuzif.
Pain. Kuzif.
What's that mean?
It's the area between your anus and your balls.
I'm not sure if it's... do you know, the weird thing about aches, and this is a weird thing about aches almost everywhere, pain, you tend to have a sense of where it is, even though if it's really bad, you know, if it's really bad, sometimes you won't, you'll misidentify. But normally you've got a sense of where pain is.
Yeah.
But aching kind of almost feels like it happens... in an abstraction of the area where it is, and that's why it's very difficult to actually explain it to a doctor or something like that. It's like aching feels like the halfway point between pain and emotional anxiety, because that happens in a place outside of your body as well, and aching seems to be... Where does it hurt, doctor? In my soul.
I'm worried that you're going to... Why that you're going to expect me to write your prescription?
No, you're okay.
I've had a generally...
This is a talking cure. That's what we call this.
Yeah, that's good. I've had a generally pleasant week, though. I think I told you because of a lucky windfall we had, I decided to buy myself a tablet. So I bought an iPad at the weekend, which is lovely. I'm very happy with it.
I assumed you were going to get paracetamol.
I was a bit disappointed. I think I'd built the experience of buying it into something it could never be. I went to John Lewis to buy it in Southampton. We've got one of those because...
You didn't want to go and buy it from a genius.
I kind of built the whole experience up to be some kind of sugar-coated blowjob.
Yeah.
Which it never could be, because all it is a cold financial transaction.
Yeah, you're buying a piece of hardware.
But it's... I didn't want
to... End of lifestyle.
That's right, yeah. But yeah, I've really bought into the lifestyle. I've found myself dancing in unusual angles, which has been fantastic. I've enjoyed that. Maybe that's where the aches and pains are coming from, to be honest with you. I'm dancing like an iTune. But I went in and... I always feel a bit of anxiety when I'm spending any sort of... money anyway, so there was that heightened sense of anxiety. We had Scarlett with us, and she was getting tired. I'd intended to show Nicola a Surface because she was thinking about buying herself a tablet. Then she got anxiety about spending money and decided not to. Scarlett started acting up.
Because she was anxious about spending money.
No, she just wanted to get out of her buggy.
Okay.
And then no one would come to see us. I think they were avoiding us because we had a crying baby with us. So I was standing there trying to get someone's attention, thinking, well, I want to spend a lot of money. Come and pay attention to me. And ended up just being quiet.
Well, it doesn't take long, does it, once you've got a bit of money?
No, it don't. And I was, come here.
You've become demanding.
Yeah.
But, over here, boy!
Well, to be fair, they missed out because I was intended by a top hat, monocle and a cane.
Yeah.
As well. But no, I've got this chip on my shoulder. Like, when I walk in and I know I'm going to buy something, I'd like someone to pay attention to me because, you know...
You can't shake the buggers off when you're just in there to browse most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like the one time I walk in there and I want to spend what to me is a significant sum of money.
It's not just didn't turn up.
And I just, by the time I paid, I was just a sweaty mess and couldn't wait to get home and didn't really want to play with the device that much because I looked at the box and it was just, well, you're a source of anxiety now.
Yeah, you are not going to measure, you are not going to live up to... Yeah. The amount of
you can only ever be a disappointment to me now. Subsequently, I tried to change my attitude towards it, but subsequently, it's been a. I'll talk about it a little bit because I've actually been getting my head around Comixology, which I have to say I quite like now. I've only ever looked at Comixology on my phone, and it's my eyes are shit, and it's no good. I really like it on the iPad. I think I told you earlier. I've been reading some Peter David Star Trek books on there, which are 69p. The Comixology store, which are really good fun. I really like those.
I believe that that is what we call in the trade a call forward to two things later on.
Indeed so.
Indeed so. Right you are, sir.
Yeah. Also, though, I had a calzone for my... That was fucking amazing.
A calzone.
If you like.
I think that's how it's pronounced.
Yeah. Oh, but it was fucking... Oh, man. It was like the greatest Cornish pasty I've ever eaten in my life.
I think that's where they got the idea for
them. I think so.
From the Cornish.
Almost certainly.
Because they don't have a word for pasty in Italian.
Well, is it like the Italians... Yeah, maybe not pasty. Is it like the Italians, like, because they used to take the pasties down the tin mines, and the reason it had the crimp is they'd eat around the crimp. So they didn't poison themselves.
That is the Italians.
Do you think the calzone is what they ate in the pasta mines?
Yes.
Because they mine pasta, right?
No, that's where they get it from.
Yeah.
There was that spoof April 1st thing on television where they claimed that it grew that pasta grew in trees. But no, it's you mine it. And get it.
They were so fucking close as well.
Because the soil in Italy is the only place where you can really get it.
Yeah. Fusilli seams, I believe, are particularly dangerous.
Most of the stuff we get in supermarkets here is genetically vat grown.
Yeah, it's like pasta eek, isn't it? It's like diamond eek.
Yeah, it's Frankenstein food.
It is.
I don't appreciate it. When we say Frankenstein food, we mean Frankenstein's monster food, obviously.
No, I mean food made out of Dr. Frankenstein.
Oh, right, okay.
It's what I like the best.
But that sounds like you've had a week.
I've had a full and fulfilling week. How about you, Nick?
The only thing really of note, I went back to work. That's been fun.
Good.
And then something else happened. What else happened? Oh, yeah, we had the dog behaviourist came round last night to...
Was it Caesar Milan?
No.
Did he go, not
the dog whisperer. No, he didn't do that at all. What we learned after several hours and spending that money was we don't treat them like dogs enough.
Okay.
Essentially. Which we kind of knew.
Do you treat them like horses?
No, we treat them like people.
Oh, you don't want to do that.
We kind of knew that, but it was good to know that, like, it was good to know that we weren't gonna that the dog isn't actually mental, which was what we were a little bit worried about. The thing about getting an expert in any situation, I think, it isn't necessarily that you couldn't work it out for yourself. It's just that they're the combination of you don't have to risk the trial and error quite so much. And they have a voice of authority, and it's comforting to have someone who seems to have some authority tell you something that maybe you would have worked out for yourself anyway. So it's cheap at half the price, really. It would have been cheaper at half the price.
Well, it's worth your dog seemed much calmer to me today when we came in.
Yes, they were. Also, I mean, we're medicating them quite heavily as well.
Yeah, you can see that. Their eyes are like piss holes in the snow, but that's...
Also, we've been pissing in their eyes.
Oh, man, that's fair enough. That's one way of asserting your dominance on them, isn't it?
When we're not talking about our weeks, We talk about comics. We'll be getting onto that in just a moment, fair listener. Or darkhead listener. We aren't intolerant.
Or bold listener.
Or bold listener. Any ethnicity we're
Auburn,
happy with.
Auburn.
Any sexuality or I mean, any way you identify, really, we're kind of happy with all of those things. We're fine with. We are the most
awkward fucking comic book
podcast on the internet. But when we're not talking about our weeks, we talk about comics. We also tend to talk about comics online a little bit. You can find me to talk to online a little bit at Nick's site. On Twitter, specifically.
Yes.
You can talk to James on Twitter at...
James Momb.
Yes. And what you can also do is you can email us about the show or just about anything to...
Momcast@gmail.com.
You can also send us audio contributions of 2 to 5 minutes about comics that will go on the show if you do it, because we really like those, because they make us sound more cosmopolitan, I believe.
Yeah.
We are on Facebook. We are on Google+. You can find us in the end on Tumblr, actually. Mm-hmm. You can find links to all of those places on our website, which is...
momcomics.com.
There at the top right of that website. You can subscribe to... Top right of that website rhymes.
Yeah. Well done.
You can subscribe to the podcast, to this podcast there. If you like what you're hearing now and you've somehow managed to... You know, if you found a memory stick with it on or something... And if the context, if it isn't clear from the context that you're listening to this in that you can subscribe to it, you can subscribe to it at iTunes or various other podcatchers. If you want to leave comments on the post on the site that this comes on, that would be lovely, because we like to know what we're doing, whether we're doing stuff wrong or right, or whether we've said something stupid or not. But you can also leave comments at the podcatcher themselves, and apparently that looks good. Makes it look good, doesn't
it? I think the more ratings you get, the more iTunes go, oh,
these people are clearly very impressive indeed.
Yeah.
They say they're awkward, but they're clearly doing something right. Because in my head, for some reason, iTunes are talking in some old-fashioned English voice. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think they talk like 1920s Bostonians, personally.
Do you? How does that sound?
I don't know.
Oh, I thought
you were doing that. Guys, something swell, she...
That sounds like Chicago or New York, doesn't it?
Oh, right. See, why did I think that was Bostonian then?
I don't know.
I've never been in 1920s America, to be fair.
Have you ever been to U?
Yes, the U of U. Maybe it's Chicagoan.
Chicagoan?
Yeah. Which is what I assume Chicagoans call themselves.
Okay.
I'm a Chicagoan, she...
I think that's a place in Canada, isn't it? It's Chicago.
Probably, eh? I'm a Shenquangwan, eh?
Or am I thinking of Sichuan, which is a
in
sort
China.
Of,
it's definitely a province. Sort of food. And a province, I think, in China, yeah.
Did they name it after the food?
Yes.
Okay, then.
It's a very spicy province.
Shall we talk about comics in what I like to refer to as us talking about this week's comics section of the show?
Yes.
Show section show.
Excellent. Well done. Is that what you like to call it
now? That's what I have started.
That's what we're doing. 170 shows, and that's what we like to do now.
I think we need to develop more of a, like, just tags, and we need to do something about the brand. It's not professional enough.
You fucked, mate. It's never going to be professional if you keep me about. First comic I'd like to talk about today, Nick, is issue 5 on Image Comics, The Shadow.
Hey,
one.
What's that you've got there, James?
It's a Quanic. it's a Shadowline Image book. It's issue 5, $5.99. And it's the final edition of Nick Spencer and Christian Ward's The Infinite Vacation.
Haven't we been waiting for this for about a year?
Not a year. It's been some time. A few months. I forget how long.
2 years.
But weighing in at 66 odd pages,
mm-hmm.
I think represents good value at $5.99. It concludes the dimension, the multiverse travelling adventures of Mark. Was it
James
the hand
doing
gesture?
Hand gesture doing to waving. Show multiverse.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's someone wavy, going wavy.
I think I do that, don't I?
Maybe
I think
you do,
I am
know.
Expressive. It's when I'm thinking, my hand starts going. It's like
what
it's,
are you doing
it's
now?
Like it's cranking the engine of my brain, my old clapped out steam engine brain. Go, come on, I'll hand crank you. Keep going,
like
you
the
bastard.
Little train that could.
Yeah,
the little
absolutely.
Engine that could.
I know I can.
I know I can.
I fucking can't. So Mark's been travelling through the multiverse with and meeting various versions of himself. The Infinite Vacation, I'm doing it again. The Infinite Vacation refers to you can take holidays being alternate versions of yourself in different parts of the multiverse. So essentially there are an infinite number of you, so you can live in an infinite number of lives as a holiday. Mark, for some reason, the corporation, the Infinite Vacation, want to shut him down, and there is also a murderous version of himself after him. And basically the book wraps up the three strands of the story. So the murderous Mark, Infinite Vacation want to take him down, and also this romance that's between him and the name of the character I forget, and I'm not going to scramble through the book to find her name.
That's fine.
Basically, it's a chase.
Yes.
Over 66 pages, him trying to shut down Infinite Vacation. It's beautifully written. It's quite subtle and nicely rounds off Mark's character, who's a bit feckless. But the character finds closure in this book. Most of the written script happens as in a monologue, so it's written as dialogue boxes. So Christian Ward is left to maybe to do the action.
Yeah, okay?
Almost every trick in the book is used here. As he travels through these different universes, it goes from portrait to landscape, from left to right. You know, I don't think we go upside down at any point, but all rendered in Christian Ward's highly stylized, very colourful style that just makes it such a beautiful, visceral experience. You feel, because of the energy that's in Christian's art, you feel like you're travelling through these multiple universes, and you feel this sort of mad sense of frenetic energy. But you get to a point where the action subsides, and you end up with this beautiful, beautiful fold-out page with just this mad palette that Christian uses, which just leads on to a beautiful and tear-jerking conclusion to the story. It definitely left a lump in my throat towards the end. You know, it is a story about a man seeking to find himself, which we've read stories like that before, but I think it concludes beautifully. And I told Nick Spencer and Christian Ward that, and I think Christian knows I'm a massive, massive fan of his art. I absolutely love it. It just pops from the page. It's so dynamic. I really enjoy it. He's so unique, you know, that I can't think of another artist that, for me, is so instantly recognisable. I really genuinely love it. I think this book, because you get a synopsis at the beginning, there's 66 pages. I think you could probably pick this up without having
read the rest,
and you could kind of pick up the threads. And even if you can't, it's beautiful enough to be well worth you spending that money even without. But I'm sure you should be able to find the other four.
We're not entirely sure how it's going to look in trade either.
No, because
if they'll be able to pull off a couple of the format tricks. So
certainly the fold-out might be difficult. I don't know. But I think it is well worth picking up as Nick says, because we don't know how it works in trade, well worth picking up as a single issue, because it is just a beautiful comic book. It is lovely.
You said it was a tearjerker.
Yeah.
Did you actually cry?
I didn't, no. I genuinely had a lump in my throat. It was a watery-eyed moment.
It was jerking at you.
It was jerking at me.
But no...
It wasn't a heart...
No emotional fluids were issued forth.
There was a heartbreaker, but there was some affirmation. It was lovely. Good. I enjoyed it a great deal. Well worth $5.99 of anyone's money.
What else did you read, James? That did look like a lovely book.
The other book I read actually made me... I did a little dance when I remembered. I'd forgotten it was coming out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's been on my standing order since it was solicited. So it's been a bit of a wait. So I forgot it was coming out, and I did a little squee and a little dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot that was coming out. I was very excited. It's issue one on Dark Horse Comics, $2.99. Of Brian Wood, and I forget the first name of the...
I think it's Carlos Dander.
Carlos Dander. And Gabe...
El-Tabe.
El-Tabe.
Gabe El-Tabe.
Who's on colours. It's Star Wars. Classic characters, all new Star Wars, set in with the characters of the classic trilogy, set, what, a month after the Battle of Yavin?
Yes, the Rebellion, from the Battle of Yavin to 5 years after, but it says that this... The events in this story take place shortly after the events in Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope.
Oh, I love IV. So, and I think they say it's about a month. And the opening section of the book sees Wedge, Antilles, Princess Leia and Luke out on a scouting mission to try and find a new base for the Rebel Alliance, which, of course, allows some chatter over the radio, setting the scene, introducing, doing the character exposition, I guess. We know the characters, but obviously Brian Wood has his own take on them. I think Luke's character is probably the most interesting, because actually there was a big change in Luke's character between Star Wars, A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. He is a considerably more serious individual in Empire than, you know, he's not the freewheeling sort of carefree farm boy that you see in A New Hope. So it's quite interesting. I think you see the early stages of him becoming this more thoughtful, more serious individual that you see in Empire and Jedi.
Yes, I can see that.
And he's kind of meditating with Leia on the destruction and the death that they've seen. And he doesn't see the Battle of Yavin as being such a positive victory as Princess Leia. So it's some really interesting chit-chat at the beginning.
He's war-worn a little bit.
He is a little bit, yeah. So there's some really interesting chit-chat, which leads on to some exciting action. And then... the rest of the book kind of introduces us to, I guess, the main players of this initial arc and kind of where this initial arc is going to go. It's a mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah, the basis of a mystery story. But obviously you get to meet Han and Chewie and the Bothan, Mon Mothma.
Mon Mothma is in it. See, she doesn't really turn up in the films until the third one, does she?
She doesn't, no.
But I guess she's supposed to have been in the background all along.
She's a very interesting character. And also, I very much enjoyed the relationship. We also see Darth Vader and the Emperor. I really like the relationship that Wood has set up there. Because, obviously, Vader has fucked up royally with the destruction of the Death Star. And the Emperor's not a very forgiving dude, is he?
No.
So there's a lovely scene in the book where the Emperor's giving Vader a bollocking.
Proper dressing down, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I really enjoyed that.
What's interesting about it is it re-establishes that the thing that you quite often forget about that first film is that there's that whole thing with Tarkin where you kind of, if you're watching it properly as a grown-up, you realise that Vader isn't the second in command, that you just come to understand he is later on. He's not... He's an agent for the Emperor rather than actually having all that much rank himself. Uh-huh. He can kill off the odd lesser dude, but like he still has to follow orders when someone like Tarkin tells him to. Mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting, and I like that they reference Tarkin in this.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's wonderful.
It's because Darth Vader was drinking whiskey the whole time he was doing that that final battle of the Death Star. He's like playing with a bottle in front of him.
Of course he is. Yeah, twiddling
it's a bit weird.
Twiddling the lid. Yeah, he was pissed out of it. That's why he missed.
Mm.
Fucking idiot. Which is, I'm paraphrasing the Emperor now.
Yeah.
But that's, I don't know about you, Nick, I had very heightened expectations for this book.
I kind of did. Yeah. I like Brian Wood. I think I had decided the art was going to look differently than it did.
Mm-hmm. I was quite surprised by the art style, actually. I didn't expect it to be so... I don't know how to describe it. It's very fresh, very modern-looking, kind of...
It is very modern-looking, and it is very...
Is it a bit cheap to say it has a Marvel feel to it?
Comic feel to it, and I think that was the other thing. I wasn't sure which direction they were going to go in with it, and... I'd have maybe liked... his artwork's really nice when he's doing the space battles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
His characters are perfectly good, but they kind of look like comic characters rather than looking like people.
They're comic book. They look like comic book caricatures of. Oh, I still see after a conversation about that word, I still stumble over it all the time. But they look like comic book caricatures of
caricatures.
Thank you of the characters that I really we know,
think,
don't they?
I really but think it, the only likeness is the is Han Solo. I don't know if they necessarily nail it on anyone else.
I mean, well, Luke is recognisably Luke. Princess Leia, I think of the most, Princess Leia has the most. She looks a bit mangry, if you ask me. The eyes are a little bit bigger, and she's quite heavily stylized. She's a lot more bendy as a woman than she, I think, Carrie Fisher was in real life. Which sounds like I'm insulting Carrie Fisher, but
no. But I mean, that's I know what you mean. The colors kind of lift it a little bit.
Yes, because they're very bold, aren't they?
It makes the space stuff look suitably epic and stuff like that. And you know, and the spaceships were kind of cool. It felt. I did like it, but the art felt more workmanlike than it's better than you normally get on a licensed book.
Yes.
It's kind of how I felt.
I think that's fair to say. I adored the space stuff. The Star Destroyers that appear in it in particular are just freaking awesome. I think I spent more time studying the panels, especially when the Star Destroyers turn up, than I think I normally give my comic books when I'm reading them. But it's I know we all love Star Wars, but I love Star Wars so much.
We don't all love Star Wars, though, do we? Okay. Not anymore.
I still do.
What I like about it is it feels like Brian Wood's treating it. It feels like he's writing it as if Star Wars doesn't have the cachet that it has, the fan cachet that it has. So he makes a proper story out of it, and he explains stuff about the Star Wars universe that most of the people you'd expect to read this would already know. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't do any of that annoying winky stuff to the camera where, like, Leia and Luke relate to each other as those characters would after what happened to them in that first film. There's no sort of wink to camera where every character, you know, where the writer clearly is thinking ahead to the fact that they're related, and even Darth Vader doesn't know any more than you'd expect Darth Vader to know at that particular stage and stuff. And I really like that stuff about it. I'm carrying around a lot of Star Wars baggage. So it's kind of the fact that I enjoyed it, the fact that I have misgivings about it, and possibly more about the fact that I have misgivings about Star Wars coming. I think one of the coolest things about it is, if I remember right, like, you don't see the Millennium Falcon in a space battle.
No.
And you don't see anyone pop a lightsaber.
No.
Which kind of suggests there's restraint there. Like I said, they're telling a good story.
You do get to see the medical frigate from Return of the Jedi, which makes me very happy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what I mean. It feels like...
And the end of Empire, sorry.
It feels like a working universe that this story is in, rather than just let's get to the weird aliens and the Jedi's sort of thing. I liked it a lot.
Which is, I think that's the problem with all the prequel stuff, is actually it destroyed the mystery of the Jedi, and they sort of, it's just spunked its bolt.
It's very focused on the mythology and doesn't really take into account the
characters
that
much. Rather than being
a
hard industrial galaxy.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's a grimy,
which it really was in Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, wasn't it?
So it's a grimy, hard existence, and that's exactly what he's invoked in this book. My expectations were high, and I felt they were surpassed. I think if you've not read it yet and you intend to buy it, my recommendation as well is to read it the way I did, and that was by listening. While you're reading it, listening to the Empire Strikes Back soundtrack.
Really? Did that help?
Which genuinely enhanced it, especially when the I think it's the Hoth medley, and you get some the Empire Strikes Back theme. Sorry, the Imperial March theme sort of fades in. And it was, so when there was a point when a Star Destroyer turned up, I was reading some of the Darth Vader stuff, and the Imperial March was playing. It felt very immersive.
Yeah.
I recommend it. I loved it.
Well, as a lapsed fan, I think it might be the first Star Wars comic in certainly in the last 10 years, that you can that as someone who isn't bothered about Star Wars, you could read and it be a perfectly solid story on its own. It's interesting and it's got intrigue and stuff.
It was good. I liked it very much. You should buy it. The other book that I'm going to talk about, and I know you read as well, I read, it's the first book that I haven't actually read it as it appears on the page. I read it in Comixology and I read it in Guided View.
But you bought it physically as well?
I bought it physically, but obviously it comes with a free download.
Oh, of course, so you read the...
So I downloaded it for free. So I actually haven't... this is the first time I'm flicking through the book and kind of seeing how the pages were laid out. It's issue number one of The Superior Spider-Man by Dan Slott and Ryan Stegman. And Edgar Delgado, because I mentioned everyone in the last one. Which obviously...
He did the colour art, and it's really nice.
It is lovely. Yeah. The art is actually fantastic, I think, the whole way through. Because it's a new artist from the Spectacular Spider-Man. What was he previously?
I don't know.
The Stunning.
Was he the Stunning?
The Demure Spider-Man.
There was the Demure Spider-Man. Yeah. There was the Humble Spider-Man.
Yeah.
There was Passive Aggressive Spider-Man, which was a bit of a weird book.
I like the Whimsical Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And picks up after... We're going to talk about probably things that happened in Spider-Man 700
yes.
in a minute. So we don't often say the spoiler warning, but if might you want to skip on 5 minutes or so if you don't want to hear anything.
We are going to talk about stuff that if you're anywhere near the comics internet, you if you have avoided hearing about what's going on in what went on in Amazing Spider-Man and what's going on with Spider-Man in general, if you've avoided it, it is probably because you are purposefully avoiding it. If you have anything to do with the comics internet, you will probably have heard about what's going on with Spider-Man. But if somehow you are saving yourself and are trying to go, I still haven't read Amazing Spider-Man 700, you are going to want to stop listening.
Yeah.
For a couple of minutes. I'll
just skip forward for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
We'll time it.
We don't have to time it. It'll be fine.
So... Obviously, at the end of seven, or well, no, before that, Otto Octavius has managed to switch places with Peter Parker. Otto Octavius's body has died, so now Otto Octavius is now the Superior Spider-Man and living Peter Parker's.
He's living as Peter Parker.
Yeah, he is.
But that means that because Peter Parker was in Dr. Octopus's body when it died, Peter Parker is dead.
Oh.
But at the tail end of that issue, at the tail end of 700, during the whole of that story, it was suggested that at the very least they had access to each other's memories.
Yeah.
They had access to all of the memories, and as such, it was as if they'd experienced all of them.
Yeah.
The reason it's worth mentioning this, even though it's kind of going above and beyond, going over the broad brushstrokes, is that if Otto Octavius was an arsehole, frankly, he's still kind of an arsehole, but he was evil.
He's a wrong'un.
He spent the last however many decades basically just being an evil prick. And so, unless you know that he has now experienced all of, had in one burst all of the Peter Parker memories that made him become Spider-Man, like Uncle Ben dying and stuff like that. Mm. Spoiler: his Uncle Ben died.
Rice was never the same, was it? Afterwards,
no. Rice was just rubbish after that. Yeah. Then you might not understand why Otto Octavius would even be going along with. Being a good Spider-Man and being a hero.
Yeah.
Albeit a much more cynical, pragmatic one. Which I think is why, for all those months in the lead up to this, before we knew what was going to happen, we were hearing about the Superior Spider-Man and possibly wondering why they'd bother calling it that. The reason they're calling it that is because superior is the kind of word that Otto Octavius throws around a lot.
Indeed, where he considers about himself to be
superior.
The Superior Spider-Man, does he not?
Yes. So anyway, sorry, I kind of...
No, that's all right.
A little bit. But yeah, so this book goes on the assumption that you mm-hmm. know all of that yeah. before you start reading it. It starts on what I think is quite a nicely composed front page. There's only four panels, but mm-hmm. it's very striking.
Yeah.
And then leads straight into action.
Yeah.
Quite a busy couple of pages. But, I mean, the thing about this, I've not
worked
really,
very nicely in kind yeah, of view.
Did it, though.
Beautifully.
I am... That sounds like a criticism. I really like... I mean, it's chaotic. It's a big battle because the Sinister Six... Is it the Sinister Six?
It is.
The Sinister Six. The all-new Sinister Six are back. Now, I think Dr. Octopus was maybe the guy who put the previous Sinister Six together. He was one of them. Mm-hmm. So he's not particularly happy about that. And at the same time, he's also, like, now he's being Spider-Man or trying to be Spider-Man, mm-hmm. Trying to be the hero. He's obviously wanting to fight these guys for two different reasons. On the one hand, he's angry because they have the nerve to call themselves the Sinister Six when he thinks they're a bit mm-hmm. rubbish. Because Otto Octavius can't really... He's not going to change overnight. Mm-hmm. He thinks most people are rubbish.
Well, that's a marvellous thing in the dialogue, isn't it? He's obviously... Spider-Man's wisecracking. I love the spice that Octavius adds to the wisecracking as well.
Well, he's not really wisecracking. He's just being a prick.
I suppose.
But, actually... When you think about it, that's not that dissimilar to... I mean, if you're on the receiving end of it, Peter Parker was probably a bit of a prick most of the time, too. But yeah, so, I mean, in this issue, we had... I don't know if you read the Avenging Spider-Man. Was it the Avenging Spider-Man? No. What's the team-up book?
The Avenging Spider-Man.
Yeah. There was a one issue of that mm-hmm. that was after 700, which was kind of all about Otto Octavius in this new role.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's already kind of established what his motivations are and all of this stuff. But he finds himself significantly affected that he's finding himself a little bit better at being the hero than you'd mm-hmm. necessarily expect. Yeah. However, he is much more pragmatic and practically minded mm-hmm. and he doesn't put up with... He's so much more arrogant than Peter Parker mm-hmm. that it's... Because we know something that the other supporting characters don't know, it does almost make you wonder how they can't tell that he's changed significantly.
But it's in the Peter Parker persona that actually it's more noticeable.
Yeah.
But I love the way Dan Slott has written the Peter Parker persona. He is such a prick.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
He really is. The thing I felt they were trying to do, the thing I felt Dan Slott was trying to do from the beginning, he spent a lot of the last year... and not just him, when Dr. Octopus has turned up in other comics, he's been more vile than he was before. He was horrible in a two-parter of Iron Man I read. Just very cruel, much crueler than I remember.
I put it down to him being poorly.
Yeah, I think it's because he's poorly. But this idea of playing around with what makes a person who they are and whether it's possible having had all of the same experiences, albeit all at once, of someone else, to still be vile, is really interesting. Mm. And I think Dan Slott manages it really well because I kind of like this version of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, could you?
I'm enjoying seeing this completely. It feels like it changes Dr. Octopus an awful lot more than it does the milieu of Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
I
agree with something that you said, because I think there was a fear with how it ended that maybe this will end quicker than we expect. I want to see this Spider-Man continue for...
Yeah.
I'd like to see this play out for a while because he is so much fun as a character.
I mean, that's one thing I without telling you everything about the issue, my only real problem with it is, and this quite often happens with comics now, it feels as if they are getting to points in the story of Dr. Octopus as Peter Parker
mm-hmm.
earlier than Yeah. They need to. I'd like this to have more room to breathe, and I'm concerned that that's not actually going to have the chance to happen. Certainly, he's got less of a poker face with Mary Jane and with the other Horizon Labs people in this issue than he did mm-hmm. have in the previous yeah. story and stuff like that. So you can sort of see that there's going to be a rush to handle. There's maybe going to be, it's going to come around quicker that people start to work out something's not quite right yeah. than maybe we expected. Ryan Stegman's art's good most of the way through and great at points. Yeah. I really, really mm-hmm. like it. There's lots of art in there that I really, really like. And it is funny, actually, I hadn't thought of this, but even from the first page, or maybe not exactly from the first page, but like, it still looks like Peter Parker.
Yeah.
Physically, it still looks like uh-huh. Peter Parker, but his facial expressions are different.
There's right at the beginning of the scene with MJ, he pulls a very uncharacteristic face, doesn't he? And he has a very snooty, haughty air about him, doesn't he, as well?
Same kind of boyish looks, but yeah, kind of very...
The puffed out chest.
He's like Evil Doogie Howser.
He is like Evil Doogie Howser. So I found curious, though, reading it in Guided View, which worked beautifully. I didn't feel like I'd missed anything. But AR doesn't kick in.
Were you expecting it to?
I'd expected if you're reading it digitally. That was more difficult to say than I thought it would be. I don't understand why AR doesn't kick in. It might be because I'm stupid.
It's kind of like you'd think it'd be like director's commentary. Maybe you'd have a button you could press. But switch having it on said off. That, I guess within Comixology, from a technical point of view, within Comixology, you'd have to launch a different app to do that.
Very possible.
And maybe they don't do that. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I can't normally get AR to work with my phone anyway. I have to use my wife's. It's got a better camera.
Oh, I think it's a fucking fast, but they...
I've enjoyed it in some cases. One thing I really liked... did you have anything else to say about Spider-Man?
No.
Although my wife still isn't really interested in comics, we did sit and go through... the first couple of books in the new Marvel Now stuff that I got happened to have AR, and I hadn't really bought many books that had it before, and so because I was sat at the table reading, which hardly ever happens, and because she was around and she had her phone, we kind of sat there and she helped me find the AR thing because she was quite good at finding the sweet spot on them, and I did quite like in the first, I think it was the first issue of Fantastic Four or maybe the first issue of FF. One thing I really liked in that about the AR was at various points in the story what the AR opened up was, and no, it was definitely FF, what the AR opened up was Matt Fraction, were actual messages from Matt Fraction where he was talking about what he was trying to do at this point in the story, or talking about how he'd ended up working. There's a bit where he tells a really nice anecdote about Mike Allred, about I think when he first met him years before, and then towards the end he starts to talk about, oh, you're nearly, this is the, I wanted to do this before the end of the book, I'll see you in a few pages, and then at the end there was basically a message about like, thank you for supporting this, we'd really like to do something different with it, etc, etc, and that isn't necessarily, it isn't necessary to your enjoyment of a book. If it costs any more to do that, maybe they shouldn't. In this case, they weren't particularly high. It was just him in front of a webcam. I guess if it doesn't cost an awful lot, it might be as cheap as QR codes, and those are relatively cheap to do. If it's easy to insert that stuff in, it is quite nice to have these little messages from the people. And it doesn't. The logo itself doesn't significantly impact on the pages.
No, not at all.
The reason I mention all that, though, but it is difficult to make it work. It is a bit of a faff. The reason I mention that is I read the third issue of Fantastic Four this week. It's $2.99 from Marvel. It's written by Matt Fraction with art by Mark Bagley and Mark Farmer and colours by Paul Mounts. This is the first real issue where we're out in space with these characters. This is the main Fantastic Four and their two kids. Reed Richards has them out in space. Reed Richards has dragged them out into the far reaches of space because he's saying he just wants the whole family to spend some time together and go adventuring, like more adventure, less action.
But it's
all kind of a pretext. He says he doesn't like the word lie, but basically he's discovered he's quite severely ill. He can't fix it at home, and so he wants to look for a solution to it out in space. And he doesn't want the family to know because he doesn't want them to worry. The conceit in the normal Marvel universe is that they're planning on being gone for a year, I think it is, but they should only be gone for 4 minutes in local time.
Yeah.
Obviously, that hasn't worked out. We're already finding out in the other book. But I've had slight misgivings about this story arc. Now, I love the idea of taking them out into space. I even kind of don't mind the... In any other book, I almost wouldn't really mind the slightly sketchy methodology that Reed Richards seems to be using. But having just read a few Jonathan Hickmans, which are all about the all about the big scientific ideas... in this issue, what happens is they land on a planet. They land on a planet which is made of unstable molecules, and excitement and adventure and danger ensues. And the actual story, the episode story, is the art's quite nice. I've never been entirely sure about Mark Bagley, but with Mark Farmer on inks, it just looks gorgeous. His work looks gorgeous. It kind of finally makes sense. There's something for every member of the team to do. The kids, the voice of the kids is really great, actually. I really like the way Matt Fraction writes Franklin and... I like the way he writes all of the characters. The problem is, the further we get into this mission of Reed Richards, the more misgivings I have about the reasoning he had for going out there. Because the only... It seems peculiar, and it's possible that, as well, I haven't read all of Jonathan Hickman's run, so some of the options that were open to his Reed Richards may no longer be open to this Reed Richards by the end of that run. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of stuff about all of the alternate Reed Richards and stuff. I don't know how that resolves itself. So maybe that wasn't ever an option for this one. And, you know, continuity, blah, blah, it shouldn't really matter. But what bothers me is how intelligent he is, and his reasoning for going out into space, going to the unknown universe, seems to be that, well, my computer has told me there is no answer to this in the known universe, therefore where I need to go is the unknown universe. And that seems sketchy to me.
Okay.
Yeah. For some reason. And it seems more sketchy the further into this mission we go. I almost would have preferred it It seems really like ungrateful to say it, because I actually quite like the idea that Reed Richards is ill and he's trying to find a solution.
That's quite cruel, Nick.
No, I don't like that, because I'm pretty sure he's going to sort himself out at some point.
Okay.
But I quite like that he's concerned for him.
You're going to be concerned if the bendy fucker dies now, aren't you?
Yeah, I will. I like the emotional position it puts him in of trying to find a solution, maybe having to think about himself for the first time, properly for the first time. And he's been self-absorbed before, but I mean, he's worried about, he's trying to fix himself rather than everything else this time. And the fact that he's keeping it from his family, it's just that reasoning for going out into space seemed sketchy. He's not following a signal or anything. It's literally, well, I've been to everywhere in the known universe. You know, I know everything about the known universe. And also, I find it a bit confusing, because I'm pretty sure in the last several decades of Fantastic Four, we've seen most of this universe explored.
Yeah, and given that he's a man who's used to adventuring through multiverses.
Yeah.
I get what you mean.
I love the conceit. I love where the conceit allows them to take us.
Yeah.
I just maybe... I find it difficult not to overthink how the conceit works.
It's flimsy in so much as it's relatively easy to overthink it. I think what I'm expecting is for the story to deliver enough for me not to think about it too much.
X-Men Legacy number 4, written by Simon Sperry, with art by George Molina, or George Molina, with colour by Rachel Rosenberg. Great Mike Del Mondo cover. The covers to this book have been brilliant. This is the comic about David Hallett, who is the son of Charles Xavier.
All right.
Who has multiple personalities inside him, each of which has control of his powers. He's like one of the most powerful and most dangerous mutant on the face of the planet. Basically, he's trying to outrun his feelings about his father, and about his father dying, but also his father kind of not necessarily being that great a father. His growing misgivings about the way his father approached the Xavier dream, which is mutants and humans like living together in perfect harmony, while at the same time I think knowing that there's a team of X-Men coming after him in a vaguely benevolent way. They see him as someone who's like not a bad guy, but who is very dangerous and not necessarily always in control of himself. And thrown into that, there have been other things motivating him, other people. There are characters both inside him and outside him who have their own potentially malevolent uses for him. And he, because of the nature of his condition, the fact that he has spent a lot of his life, although he's like in his, I think he's in his 20s, he's not really much more than a kid still. He spent a lot of his time either in comas or whatever. He's quite easy to manipulate into certain places. So this issue is the fourth issue. It's also the point at which the X-Men finally catch up with him. So it's kind of a crunch point. A lot of things happen in this. It's the first issue that really has sort of a traditional fight between super powered individuals. But there's still plenty of this. There's still plenty of this inner life stuff going on with David Haller, where he's having to get the people inside him under control at the same time as he's trying to deal with the stuff outside him. Cy Spurrier balances that really, really well. You're never that confused about what's going on, even though sometimes David Haller is experiencing two different things at once. It's handled really well by the writing. And Molina handles it really well in the art as well. There's also this really interesting thing going on with the X-Men where I think Spurrier himself looks at the X-Men in kind of a sideways way. It's like he respects he kind of respects the position they hold in the Marvel Universe, but doesn't necessarily like get why they're heroes, or doesn't necessarily like them so much. I hesitate to say he doesn't like them, because they are handled, although you sort of see this, and I kind of feel that that's maybe the case from having read other stuff by him. His worldview wouldn't necessarily be in line with this paramilitary group going around the world thinking they know what's best for everyone. And in recent issues, David Haller's Haller's attitude, the way he thinks about the X-Men, has kind of been changing ever so slightly, like thinking of them as basically almost thinking of them as well-meaning bullies who follow his dad's dream kind of unquestioningly. And I did wonder how that was going to pan out in this. And again, he kind of, the way the X-Men are handled in this issue, it's sort of quite a sideways look at them. They are kind of jerky in it, but at the same time, they're also, it's not a dissimilar trick to the way Otto Octavius in Peter Parker's body is being handled, in that you're kind of getting this sense of characters who are kind of jerks, kind of arrogant jerks, but at the same time are like genuine formed characters that you can have a certain amount of sympathy with. It would have been easy for them to be the villains of this story, and that never really happens. And each of them has their own voice rather than just being characters that are intruding into this book because, you know, practical reasons dictate they have to turn up at some point. You know, I really liked this issue. I wasn't entirely sure about the art in the first couple of issues. There were moments when I really liked it, moments where I wasn't so sure about it. I really, really like Molina's art in this. And I like seeing him handling characters that I'm familiar with as well. But he does as good a job as Spurrier of juggling the bits where there are two or more things going on at once. It's good. It's a really good issue. I liked it a lot. I'm talking more than I intended to, though. So I'll very quickly talk about Avengers Arena number 3.
You should say as many words as you intended to about that, but say them at twice the speed that you normally talk.
Okay, then I don't know if I can do that. It's number 3. It's $2.99. It's quite a boring cover. It's just a big A by Greg Horn. Written by Dennis Hopeless, with art by Kev Walker, who we know as a long-standing 2000 AD artist, James, although his work has evolved a lot since then. Mm-hmm. With colour by Frank Martin. Again, all of these books are books where the colourist has done a lot to the art as well, you can sort of tell. Third part of what's essentially Battle Royale playing out in... There's no point even pretending it's like mm-hmm. Battle Royale playing out in the Marvel Universe. It's the first issue where it took me a few seconds to... a few pages to dial into the narrative. But basically, the story is that all of these teenagers have been put into this situation where they're going to have to fight to the death. Up until this point, they have become... And they don't necessarily all know each other that well. Up until this point, they are quite... They've been wary of each other, but so far none of them have turned.
Yeah.
Except this is the first issue that sees... this is the first issue that sees that someone, one of them, is hunting around all of the different packs. There are three or four camps of them forming up, despite the fact that they've been told only one of them is going to mm-hmm. get to survive. Someone is stalking around the sides of the camp. All of them are kind of aware that someone is starting to play the game and hunt. They're just not sure who.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sure why. There's a couple of... What's slightly odd in this one is the previous issues have been completely unambiguous. When a character has died, they've set the stakes The stakes are high. They didn't have a problem with killing off characters. Mm. Maybe the more, maybe even characters that you might recognise. Mm. In this one, there are a couple of quite violent sequences, but I'm not entirely sure if the people involved in them died. But Kev Walker's art is absolutely gorgeous. So this follows each issue has focused on a particular character. I think it's a coincidence that they've all been female characters so far. But it focuses on a character. This one focuses on a character called Cammy, and she's very different from the past two, but she's also very interesting. She's a kid who was kidnapped by aliens when she was very young from Earth, disappeared, and then turned up at SWORD, SWORD, mm-hmm. Having apparently become a sort of a space pirate. She's still only tiny. She's still like only a quite small teenager, but she's also apparently this space pirate hero, mercenary sort of gun-toting lunatic. I'm really liking this comic, despite my early misgivings about like who exactly it was for. I thought this was a really good issue. So
it's for you.
Apparently, if not anyone else, it's certainly for me. And I think that as much as it's quite cynical, I understand where our friend Max Barnard was coming from about it being quite cynical. I still mm-hmm. think it was quite a cynical pitch.
Well, he's a fine one to talk.
Well, yes, he is a cynical bitch.
Yes.
I think it was quite a cynical pitch, but I think Dennis Hopeless is, even where these are familiar tropes...
Mm-hmm.
I think he's handling the writing really well. And Kev Walker's art is just amazing.
it's quite nice that you managed to get a slight in there against Max Barnard, because I'm still at war with him and Mike Georgiou.
Why, what happened?
Who are still bullying me and telling me I look like the light entertainer Chris Moyles.
Is bullying a slightly strong word?
No.
Is it possible that the reason Mike, our friend Mike, is saying that
your
is
friend,
because...
Your friend Mike.
Oh, is because Greeks just can't... Like, maybe Greeks are Moyles blind. Maybe he can't help it, because he's not the first Greek who said that about you.
Greek, he's racist, or they all are. Apparently,
they all are.
All fat English men look like Chris Moyles, apparently.
Yeah, I think that sounds
which, bad. Sorry, you all look alike to me.
Yeah, it's not
That's
right.
What he said. Max Barnard, not sure what his excuse is. He's been in New Zealand. Maybe it's a hemisphere thing.
It's possible it is. I don't know.
But that was. But the Greeks are in the same hemisphere as us.
He might have just smelt blood in the water. Sometimes peer pressure can get, like, can get pretty intense. Maybe he can't help himself. I think you should lay it all at Mike's door.
Okay, it's all at Mike's door, man.
Okay.
I still haven't seen the picture of the how he's managed to cope with me in the crowd scene.
You look great.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
You lie.
Well, I think so. It's on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't do Facebook.
Oh, well, then that's your problem.
Actually, someone made a really good point on Twitter the other day, and I endorse this. If you're on Twitter and you post a link to Facebook, you're a wanker.
That's hardly fair.
No, it isn't. I'm on Twitter because that's where I want to be. There's nothing I hate more when someone posts something. Oh, that could be quite interesting. I click the link and it's, oh, you have to sign in. Well, I'm not on Facebook, so...
Well, sometimes though, Facebook is where the good stuff is. Disclaimer, Facebook is never where the good stuff is. Anyway, that was our This Week's Comics. We talk about This Week's Comics from the week that they came out in this
it
week.
Is. We're both in a closed posture as well now. I'm worried about where the podcast is going to go from here. We're both sat here with our arms crossed.
I've had backache.
We should take my mind off your and my backache by talking about some news.
This is what I like to call the newsy, awkward bit that's roughly around the centre of the podcast bit.
That's what we're calling that now, then, isn't
yeah.
it? I like that bit too. Shall we start with some positive news?
Yes.
It's been all over Twitter this week, but I think it's positive for British creator-owned type creators.
Yes.
Titan, who publish graphic novels, collected editions, and so forth in the UK.
Yes. And magazines, lots of official magazines and things, or certainly they used to.
Magazines,
yes.
Have announced Titan Comics, which is a imprint of creator-owned books.
Yes.
They have several books coming out. We'll probably put a link to where you can find all of that information rather than me sitting here and listening.
There were a couple of things. Am I allowed to look at your tablet?
You can. It's on my tablet device.
I think it's working really well, you having the tablet.
There's a dinosaur telling you about it. Number Cruncher, of course.
That's what I was
saying. Cy Spurrier, PJ Holden.
Yes, that's the one I wanted to talk about.
Solid State Tank Girl, number one. What do you think?
I don't know what that is.
It looks all right. The art looks a bit shonky. But
Number Cruncher is a story that... Was it in the magazine? I seem to remember...
I think so.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Are they going to be doing the Brit release of Solid...
That's why I was being snarky about the art, because it's by an artist we love very much.
Warwick Johnson Cadwell.
That's right. So that's Solid State Tank Girl. Number Cruncher was in
2000 AD. It was advertised in 2000 AD, but wasn't in 2000 AD. I am very glad that that's coming out.
But there's all sorts of really exciting...
Thrud the Barbarian.
All sorts of really funky stuff coming out, which is very exciting.
We shall see. Hopefully that will last. I guess that was good news.
Yes. The bad news is, and we're a couple of weeks behind, we knew about it.
Are we? Maybe we are.
We are, yeah. We should have mentioned it last week. But obviously, I'm sure you're aware if you're on social media or the comics internet. But creator, writer, Peter David suffered a stroke a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Which sounds like he's making a steady recovery.
Yes.
At the moment. The sad news from a personal point of view is, I know you mentioned this a while ago, but we are, certainly you and I are attending... the London Super Comic Con, where he was due to be a guest.
Yes, and he's almost certainly not going to
be there. Almost certainly not going to be there now, yeah, which is unfortunate for us, But obviously we hope he makes a speedy and full recovery.
It wouldn't be a nice thing to happen to someone, even if they hadn't written some of my favourite comics of several years, of the last several years.
I'm very much enjoying reading those Star Trek books by him.
Which you've been reading on Comixology.
I have. And they're books that, you know, I picked up books like that in the 80s, and they were kind of throwaway, but they're written with such craft, you know. They're really lovely.
He's an amazing writer in that he was always very versatile in a way not every writer is, in terms of being able to write licensed stuff and being able to write long-standing. Like, he was kind of the master of the really long mainstream superhero comic arc. And so because of him, I've got tons and tons of issues of Hulk, an awful lot of issues of X-Factor. But he also kind of, he's one of the only people, I think, who's managed to create a kind of a whole new series of Star Trek stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard of, there's a series of novels that he did, and I can't remember what they're called. They're either called The New Frontier or something like that, which was about a whole new ship.
Sure.
That was all made up of characters who weren't characters we knew, that actually was insanely popular with fans.
Yeah.
So he's a very, very flexible writer. And he's not necessarily, I know he's well loved among comics, but he's not necessarily held up as quite the awesome comic writing god he actually is. So I love him. I think he's great. And I my thoughts definitely go out to our thoughts, sorry James, definitely go out to him and his family, and I hope he feels better soon.
Absolutely.
And maybe he'll be able to come over next year.
Let's hope so. But I'm really, because I am now confirmed, and I am definitely going along with you to LSCC. I did my usual thing now. I'm getting slightly anal about wanting to book train tickets and hotels. But you've got a flyer behind you. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's going to be good. It's going to be the first time we've been away from home together for a couple of years.
Yeah, good. It's going to be exciting. It's the first con as well where I'm actually genuinely tempted to take books with me. I don't normally do that. But I'd quite like to take my Crisis on Infinite Earths with me.
For George Perez.
Yes. And maybe Spider-Man 700.
That's true, because Dan Slott's going to be there, isn't he? That's quite exciting.
I would like to get his scribble on that.
One other thing I read this week, I think it was at one of the bigger comic sites, but someone actually wrote a post about the best comic colourists of the last year, which I'll link to in the show notes. But it was interesting because we have noticed colourists a lot this year, I think. And so I think Dean White was one of the people who was named, who's working some of the Marvel books we've been reading recently. It's just amazing. The person writing was most excited by was Jordi Belair, whose name is on a ridiculous amount of the comics I'm reading and have been reading over the last year. So it's good to see that.
Journey into Mystery. Was that one of them? You kept mentioning, isn't it? It is.
Jordi is a lady.
I'm so sorry. You can edit that out. I'm sure you mentioned her name.
Well, specifically, we keep mentioning her in connection with Manhattan Projects.
Yes, of course.
But the variety of different books that she works on and how different they all look is incredible. But then you also mentioned Fiona Staples, because obviously she does all of the art on Saga, and that book just looks amazing.
It is beautiful.
But I don't know if it's like all done by one person and it's fully painted, can it really be? Is it fair to say that they did great colouring? Because I'd say a lot of what's good about colouring is how, and the same with inking, is what it brings up out of the artist's work.
It's how the artist is using the palette on their own work. It's like Christian Ward, one of the most distinctive things about his work. I mean, he's got a beautiful line style, but it's how he applies colour to that that really makes it stand out. And the same is for Fiona Staples. So colouring's part of their process.
Yeah, sure.
The choices.
Like we call, we've got the word drawfer, maybe. Yeah. We could call them full all of the artsters. No, that doesn't really work.
Fartsters.
No, I don't. That sounds. It shouldn't, but for some reason that sounds wrong.
Allerists.
Allerists.
Yeah.
You see, that would definitely cover someone like David Wynne, who does a lot of his own writing and drawing, and he can do really good colouring.
He's an allerist author. Yeah. I'll think of something for next week. That'd be my homework. I won't, I'm lying.
That was what I like to call the middly awkward-y bit.
It was quite awkward. Yes. I had an awkward bit where I got someone's gender incorrect.
Yeah, that happens.
Because I'm a...
It's been a while since you've been in the game.
Yeah, it's a very long time.
Do you want to do your spotlight, James?
I don't know what gave you that impression. Yes. It's the next in my Asterix series. I've saved paper.
Well done.
I am looking at the Wikipedia page on my tablet.
Excellent.
Yeah. Because this year doesn't contain an Olympic Games... but last year did. I thought now would be a really good time to talk about the 12th in the Asterix series, Asterix at the Olympic Games.
By?
Goscinny and Uderzo.
Yes.
Yes. René and Albert. As I said, it's 12th in the Asterix series. It was obviously serialised in Pilot magazine between issues 434 and 455.
Obviously.
In 1968, obviously, to coincide with the Mexico City Olympics. Read along with me, why don't you? and then first published in the UK in 72, obviously, to coincide with the Munich Olympics.
I don't think it's such a good idea to mark with highlighter on your iPad, which bits you want to say.
It won't... Shit!
Yeah,
it won't,
it's okay.
You can sort
it out after.
No, I want to do it. No. Fuck it. I'll get someone to do it. I'll get my domestic staff to help me out with that.
Get an Apple Genius.
Fuck those guys. I'll go to John Lewis and see if they've got any policy.
John Lewis geniuses.
Policy. But they're not geniuses, but they're fucking polite. I tell you, they're very nice people.
John Lewis servants.
John Lewis servants. I've got my order in for one. I'm looking forward to it arriving. I'll tell you all about it next week.
Okay.
Don't ask me how that fits in with my left-wing credentials, because I think they might have gone the fucking pot, mate, to be honest with you. I'm an extreme white right-wing Randian now. I've been listening to a lot of Rush, and I can't help myself.
Fucking... I always knew you were quite Randy.
Hey, you impinging my personal freedom, is what I'm saying.
Don't you get all Randy at me.
I can't help it. I can't think now because of the blood. all the blood. Where are we? We're in Gaul.
Are we?
In a village that we know so well. And there is excitement at the Roman camp of Aquarium. Because obviously the village that Asterix lives in is surrounded by these Roman garrisons to stop them doing who knows what. Interesting enough, actually, we're planning a holiday to Asterix country. Very near where he lives, we're going to go to a campsite near Roscoff.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be good. But for once, spirits are up in the Roman camp of Aquarium, where the current garrison leader, who is called a centurion... He's a centurion, which don't make sense to me. He's called Gaius, very ambitious.
Oh, that's good.
And his legionary Gluteus Maximus are preparing for the Olympic Games. Gluteus Maximus is a fine figure of a man, full of muscles, blonde hair and square chin. He feels himself to be the fastest, strongest and fittest man in the world. Until that is, he goes out running in the forest one day and bumps into, figuratively, not literally, Obelix and Asterix.
Obelix and Asterix.
Asterix, yeah. From the Gaulish village that we know so well.
Yes.
He's somewhat crestfallen when they very easily overtake him running, and when he shows them what a good javelin thrower he is, Obelix throws back a tree and smashes him right up in the hooter.
Obelix is such a... That's quite psychotic. That could easily kill a man.
Oh, Obelix is nuts, mate. Yeah. He's nuttier than Gerard Depardieu with a Russian passport. So,
I don't know what that means.
No. He's got a Russian passport now. He's well fucking pleased with it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's a Russian now. Because he had to pay 75% tax. And he said, I'm moving to Belgium. And François Hollande, the Russian... is he prime minister or president? French.
French, yeah.
Does it matter? He said, well, that's a bit fucking... What, you're going to Belgium? That's a bit petulant. Jeopardy went, fuck you! I'm going to fucking Russia! And now he lives in Russia. He's got a Russian passport.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which wasn't petulant at all. But there's a flat rate of 15% income tax in Russia. So he's a lot happier because he gets to keep a lot more of his money.
Moving along, though, anyway.
So, Glutinous Maximus. Glutinous Maximus is a bit crestfallen. This could take a while. Glutinous Maximus is a bit crestfallen. So, Gaius very ambitious. He's like, right, fuck this. I'm off to see the Gauls and have a word with them. Which is a ballsy move for a centurion of a camp surrounding the Gaulish village, because he must know they're tasty.
They're a bit tasty.
Anyway, he turns up and asks to see Chief Vital Statistics, who's having a bath, so his shield bearers bring him out of the bath, and the Roman says, can you, look, we're going to the Olympic Games, he's training, can you back the fuck up?
Yeah.
Because actually, we're trying to do something that doesn't affect you, it's just for Romans and Greeks.
Mm.
Back off. You can't do it, we're going to do it. Vital Statistics is, whatever. And then he has a little chat with Gaius, very ambitious, tells Glutinous Maximus, he cheers right up. But Vital Statistics has a little chat with Getafix, Asterix and Obelix. And after a little chat, they go, oh, the Roman, the Olympic Games sound like fun, but it's only open to Greeks and Romans. And Asterix is like, well, we are Romans, innit?
Yeah.
We are Romans, because
we're part of the...
conquered, even though we're not, because we're the one village that still
is holding out.
But, you know, they're essentially...
we're Gauls,
yeah,
and the Gauls have been conquered.
Exactly. So, in the village, they have a little competition to see who should represent the village. What's really nice here is we're almost at the point now where the wider cast of characters is almost fully established. So, we've got characters now like Vital Statistics, his wife, Impedimenta. Fully Automatics, the blacksmith, Geriatrics, the old man of the village, and so forth. There's only a few of those regular characters now that aren't quite established, and I think in the next couple of books we finally see that full cast of characters fleshed out. But because of that, they can have a trial for who's going to enter the Olympic Games, and you can play off the characters that are already familiar with, which is lovely, and it feels like a richer place for it. Obviously, they decide that Asterix and Obelix are going
to represent them.
Because Asterix is smart and Obelix fell in the cauldron as a baby. So, Gaius, very ambitious, and Glutinous Maximus get wind of this. And one of the memes all the way through this story is whenever Glutinous Maximus is concerned or down, he starts sweeping with an old-fashioned broom. So, you see, just before we're about to set off, they're all wrapping up their things, and Obelix wraps up for the journey of Menia to take with him, and Glutinous Maximus wraps up his broom because he's concerned.
Why do we ever work out why he always has to have a Menia with him? Is it just like a comfort thing?
He's a Menia delivery man. That's what he does. It's his stock in trade.
But does he know that someone needs one?
He never knows. It's just like he's
yeah.
I think he follows the ABC principle of many a sales.
Okay.
Always be carrying.
Okay, no, that's good.
Yeah. So the whole village, apart from the women, decide to, that's how they rolled back in those days.
It's old-fashioned, isn't it?
It is old-fashioned, yeah, but it's not sexist, not racist, because it happened thousands of years ago, so it's fine. So they go on they board a yacht with a not at all racist looking drummer.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, Odiseau.
Yeah.
And Goscinny.
But they find out they have to row themselves. They encounter the pirates on the way to Greece. And finally, they get to Greece. And essentially, this is it's a parody, as we find out, it's a parody on performance enhancing drugs in sport.
Right.
As well as being Asterix in Greece. So yeah. We get to visit some stereotypes about Greek people who have very big noses.
That's true, we do.
Well, yours is no bigger than mine.
Mine isn't,
but
the rest of the families.
And one of the
Your nose is bigger than mine.
It is, yeah, without a shadow of doubt. One of the tropes all the way through this is Greeks having a large and vast, and having no new, I kind of know this is true, a vast network of cousins.
Yeah, no, we got a lot of cousins.
You have got a lot of cousins.
And they all think you look like Chris Moyles.
They all fucking think I look like Chris Moyles. Which is, you know, don't get yourself a Greek friend if you're fat, because they will think, if you're a fat white man with a fat face, don't make friends with Greek people. They're all going to think you look like Chris Moyles.
If you're a fat white man with a tiny little pin face, you should be all right.
Yeah, you'll be fine. They probably think you look like, I don't know, Eamon Holmes. He hasn't really got a pin face, has he? So there's lots of humour about Greeks and their cousins. What there also is in this is they travel around the Parthenon as it would have looked back then. There is the opportunity for Odysseus to show his absolutely pristine line work when it comes to drawing backgrounds and historical monuments and so forth. It is absolutely beautiful. There's a lovely energy in this as well, as the Gauls enjoy themselves and the Greek hospitality. There's lots of humour to be had with what is essentially a jolly boys outing in Greece. But eventually we get down to it and we go to the Olympic Village, which again features some beautiful art. One of my favourite things when I was a kid was looking at his art of ancient Roman buildings and so forth. It's so rich, so detailed, yet still has that flat, clear line style as well. It's gorgeous. The Romans are a little bit down, though, once we get to the training village, because they know that they're going to get their arses whipped.
Mm. Not literally.
Yeah.
Figuratively.
But there's a nice little cameo here. As the Gauls arrive at the Olympic Village, only get a fix, Asterix and Obelix are allowed in, not all of them, but there's two men there to greet them who bear an uncanny likeness, a picture above them, I beg your pardon, bears an uncanny likeness to Goscinny and Odysseus. So there's a sort of funny little cameo, a self-referential piece there. I know that because I read the Wikipedia page.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I can't pretend I knew that before I read the Wikipedia page this week. The Gauls spend some time winding up the Romans, who at this point have just about given up. They're drinking, gambling, sweeping the floor, and eating all sorts of lovely Roman dishes, which is upsetting the Greek competitors. Mm. Now, obviously, the Greek Olympic officials take it very seriously. It is, after all, a sacred games.
Yeah.
And so they can't have any more of this. So they go and see the Romans and they say, look, will you fucking turn it in?
Yeah.
Because we've had it. It's a bit echoes. And this is a nice thing. Echoes earlier in the story when Very Ambitious turns out the vital statistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Says, can you turn it in?
And calm, he
says,
down.
Fuck off.
Sort your people out.
Yeah. I get even more sweary during these, don't I?
Yeah, yeah. They're especially when it's just me. There's a lot of manly energy in this room right now.
Yeah, it's because you caused me to get to
Randy. You became Randian. Tumescent.
That's it. Tumescent. That's the word I was scrabbling around for. And the Romans say to the Greeks, "Well, there's no point. They're doped up on magic potion." And the Greeks say, well, I think you'll find there's rules about that. And
they're very sophisticated, the Greeks.
They are, and it's basically they're not allowed doping.
Mm.
So the Romans are then forced to train, and they agree that only Asterix will enter on behalf of the Gauls. Even though he's, by some way, the shortest of the Gauls. I would say fully automatics in terms of someone who isn't permanently inebriated on magic potion, as Obelix is. Looks the fittest and most athletic of the Gauls. But no, because Asterix is smart,
he gets to be the one.
Anyway, their asses get creamed by the Greeks, who are the most superior athletes.
Everyone's do.
Yeah, everyone gets their asses spanked by the Greeks. Mainly the Spartans. Are you a Spartan origin at all?
No, I'm not. I'm quite a hoarder.
Yeah, the Cypriots are quite feckless in this book.
Yeah, no, they are.
That's not true at all. There's no Cypriots in here at all. They couldn't be.
No, typical. They'd fucking leave us out.
They could be asked to go. And because the Romans getting so little traction in the games, the Greeks agree that the Greeks. I've just seen that that guy has got a cousin called Diabetes, which is very funny. Obviously, there's all the same name puns. I didn't want to name them all because, you know, come on, we've got to get through this. so they're going to have a race for the Romans only. But the Romans are a little bit shifty. They're not sure if they're going to beat Asterix. But they overhear Asterix and Getafix having a conversation about how he's brewed up a cauldron of magic potion left it in that shed over there that isn't locked or guarded at night. So the Romans, being the devious lot they are, steal the magic potion. No one's any the wiser, but slightly suspicious how they run side by side and finish exactly at the same time. But Getafix is smart. And when the race is finished, he says to the officials, they're full of magic potion up to their ears. And Asterix says to them, cheats, and sticks his tongue out. And when the Romans stick their tongue out, their tongues are all completely blue. And Getafix says, well, I'll put some food colouring in the potion as it goes. And there you go.
And they're some 24-hour laxatives.
That's right. So they are shitting water. And Asterix is awarded the wreath, but because they're kind, we find out at the right at the end that he's given his wreath to two more deserving individuals than him, and we see that Caesar is actually very pleased with Glutinus Maximus, very ambitious, because very charitably Asterix has given his prize, his golden palm, to the two Romans, which is very nice. It is a funny book. It's one of the, as I said, because the world is so rich, the books feel increasingly linear. It's not yet got to the point where they reach a level of maturity, but the satire is more fully formed, and they feel like they're about something rather than, as I said, the early books, which are just gags joined together. It's another one that I love very much. It holds up very well. It looks beautiful. It flows beautifully. There are some really funny little gags in it as well. And it feels very comfortable because you're so familiar with the village at this point. Asterix, Olympic Games, probably for most people not worth reading for another 3 years. Really glad I could fit it in this year in which we host the Olympics in Ulfuck.
Interestingly, not interestingly, but if you have children and you want to read that with them, you might want to work out how you're going to explain the black characters to them before you read it to them.
There are at least a couple of instances where the Numidian characters, as they're described, are very black with massive red lips.
I hadn't noticed in any of the previous books quite as much in that one.
Asterix and the Chieftain's Shield is very prominent in as well.
Okay.
It's highly unfortunate. I think I know what I'm doing with Scarlet. I'm starting off on Tintin in the Congo, and I figure, well, things can only get better from there.
This is all on the up. Once you've covered that, you'll have covered everything.
If she survives that without being a raging racist, then we should be golden.
Thank you for that, James. That was thorough.
That was it? Oh, God, did it feel like it lasted that long?
No, it was
so
fine.
Sorry.
It was really good. I liked it. Thank you.
Hold on. Well, it's still Thursday, so that's something.
No, it was cool. I liked it.
Cool.
Thank you for that. That was brilliant.
Asterix and the Cauldron next, if you're reading along.
I love it when you talk about Asterix.
I love it when I read about Asterix, as I said before, because it means I get to read an Asterix book. And
is that a new one you bought that?
Every single one. I'm refreshing my whole Asterix collection on the back of this. So,
excellent.
The Orion hardbacks, which I'm buying, modern ones, are freaking gorgeous.
I like them.
And hopefully, like I said, by the time I finish, the new one should be out, which will be the first Asterix book not written by a Goscinny or an Uderzo.
And you'll have covered all of the other ones, so you'll be in fine form to say, oh, it's not as good, I ate it.
Well, to be fair, I'm not as keen on the Yudizo only books as I am on the books as a team. So,
oh, right. Okay.
I haven't read all of the later ones. From what I've read, it hasn't got a very high bar to reach.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately.
Well, thank you for that, though. What are you doing with the rest of your week? With you, this is what I like to call the bit where we talk about the next 7 days of things we might do that is partly aspirational, partly stuff we've already planned out.
That's what we're calling this now, is it? After 170 episodes, that's what we're calling this now. It's really boring. I'm working. I've got to do some overtime, so I've got work on Saturday. Depending on how Saturday goes, I may well have to work on Sunday.
You're pulling some overtime.
I am.
You've got to clear this caseload.
Yes, something like that.
There's a serial killer on the loose, we think.
I opened up a cold case and it got hot.
Yeah, your partner is out of action.
Yes.
So they've put you together with this hothead who you're not entirely sure of.
That's more true than you think, actually.
You ain't got time for this shit. You're only 5 days from retirement.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, doesn't look good for you.
Doesn't look good for me, but we'll see how it comes off. So I'm not doing anything particularly exciting apart from pretty much solidly working. If I get Sunday off, I might go and look at beds with my wife.
If you get Sunday off, it might be a good idea to stay off the roads.
Really?
Yes, because the thing I'm doing this week is I'm having my first driving lesson on Sunday.
Of course.
My first driving lesson since I was 17, so my first driving lesson in over 20 years.
That's a long, long time ago.
Long, long time ago.
Can you still remember?
How to drive.
How your driving used to make you cry.
I can vaguely still remember. I don't think it's like falling off a bike. Or driving a log.
No, it hurts a lot more if a car falls over.
Yeah. In the forest, does anyone hear it go?
Yeah, no, don't know.
So there's that, and other stuff that's going to be happening in the next week. Probably nothing good. That's probably the best thing that's going to be happening is me, my first driving lesson. Expensive. Behaviourist was very expensive.
Yeah.
The driving lessons are going to be expensive. So
life's expensive.
You know, life is expensive. Yeah. But you know,
we're all in this together, though.
Yeah. We're all in this together.
Except me, because I had a windfall, so...
And those bloody, bloody Tories.
Yeah. Well, I'm one of them now. I'm a Tory, I'm a 1%er.
You're not really, though,
so I had a little bit of
You're
good
more
fortune.
Like top 40%, maybe.
I'd say...
Bottom of the top 40%.
Yeah. Yeah, because that works with my lower middle class chip on my shoulder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's us. Thank you very much, James. You are awesome as always.
Thank you. You're awesome.
And thank you, listener. You are patient and loving and wise and kind as always. That's what I'm calling you this week.
And did we mention handsome?
And did we mention handsome and pretty?
Yeah.
If you're a boy.
Yeah.
We love you. You rock out with something. And we're going now.
Bye-bye!
Out.
Oh, fuck, that makes it even seem even more fucking futile.
Yes.